Good morning. Welcome to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Another bad weekend for the Toronto Blue Jays. Awesome. Really fired up to talk about it. As the Blue Jays continue hurtling toward a record for most irritating season by an otherwise good team in league history, maybe. Certainly in recent history for this team and this franchise. The Blue Jays dropped 2 of 3 to the Cleveland Guardians. They have now dropped 4 of 7 to the Cleveland Guardians over the last couple weeks, in between which the Cleveland Guardians lost a bunch of games to other good teams and bad teams. The Guardians went 4-8 in between the two Blue Jays series, and then 4-3 across those two series. A lot of the same problems persist, certainly with Friday's 5-2 loss. The Blue Jays can get next to nothing going. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and George Springer, both homer, but that's it for the offense. The Jays only get 8 base runners total. Chris Bassitt was okay, not great. You know, you zoom out and his ERA is up to 4 at this point. Still fine for a mid-rotation starter, but it's been a lesser go for him of late. But realistically, a mid-rotation starter holds an opponent to 4 runs, you should be able to win that game if you are a playoff caliber offense, which the Toronto Blue Jays are not. So a pair of solo shots, all they get in that one. Saturday rolls around, the Blue Jays say, hey, it's the once a week, we'll start Davis Schneider. It's against a lefty. We could use a little offense in the lineup. He singles, doubles, walks, and homers. Huh. I wonder if someone or all of the people watching this team could have brought up over the last couple weeks that you have made roster decisions and transaction decisions based around keeping a bat on the bench that is there. You're allowed to use them. Blue Jays use Davis Schneider. Huge boost offensively. Again, single, double, home run, walk. As part of that, the Jays put together multiple big innings as a team. They win 8-3. Hyunjin Ryu was pretty good around some errors. It's nitpicking. I didn't love pulling him as much as the bases were loaded. Yes, but no hard contact. A couple of errors behind him. He had been monstrously pitch efficient and induced some pretty comical swings with the curveball in that one. Jimmy Garcia comes in, hits a guy to score a run, and then has 3 of the nastiest strikeouts we've seen from Jimmy Garcia all year. Bullpen mostly hangs in there from there, although the Blue Jays lose Eric Swanson in that game. It ends up he hits the IL with thoracic spine inflammation. As bad as that sounds, anytime you are, I think this is just the nature of the back, is like a couple years ago, the Jays would maybe just call this like back soreness or something like that. Getting as specific as thoracic spine inflammation, it sounds bad. Arden Zwelling reporting, though, that it's possible Swanson could be throwing within 10 days, maybe not a super long absence here, depending on how he responds. Obviously, this time of year, any injury, you start wondering about someone's playoff availability, which, A, you have to get there for that to matter, and B, sounds like the Blue Jays have maybe avoided with Swanson here. Another scare in that game is Dalton Varsho kind of caught his leg trying to steal second base, oversliding the bag. He ended up staying in the game. No damage there, although it looked awkward for a moment. So the Jays win 8-3, and you're heading into a rubber match. You think, hey, Friday was really, really bad, but you're up against Noah Syndergaard. He is probably shouldn't be starting in the major leagues anymore. The bats got going a little bit Saturday. Maybe you put something together, take the series win at least. Instead, Blue Jays lose 10-7 in 11 innings in one of the more frustrating games you can remember. Again, Vlad, Springer, and Schneider all home run. So that those 3 players all had multiple home runs on the weekend. That's your one positive from there. And I know you might look at, if you missed the game, you'd maybe look at the 10 in the score column for the Guardians and hang this one on the pitching staff. If you're doing that, you know, you'd say, hey, this Guardians team hasn't scored 10 runs since they were a fictional team in Major League 2. This is not a team that has much offensive pop at all. And as much as Jose Ramirez had a monster weekend and is an MVP caliber guy, this offense came into this series with Cole Calhoun as by far their best hitter over the last month. That's what we're dealing with here. The way the game played out also, though, should nudge you away from worrying about the pitching side of things. Not that it was terrific, but the Blue Jays had many chances to win this game. Now, on the pitching side, Kikuchi gave up 4 over 6 innings. He got touched up for a home run. It's the first time in a long time we've seen him give one up. But behind him, Genesis Cabrera and Jordan Hicks were fine. Tim Meza got in some trouble. That kind of kept this one closer longer, let the Guardians not only catch up, but pull ahead in the 8th inning, and the Jays would answer back. But along the way, a lot of frustration in this one. 7th inning, Jays put runners on first and second, nobody out. Santiago Espinal lays down a sacrifice bunt to move them to second and third. And while I'm not the world's largest proponent of bunting, you're up 5-4 at that point. You're moving 2 potential insurance runs up 90 feet. You are at a point in the order where, I mean, Brandon Belt's on deck, so you have a confidence level perhaps in his ability to at least put one in the air. So they bunt those guys over, and it's Santiago Espinal at the plate. That's Bo Bichette's spot in the lineup, but he's out at that point, which we'll get to in a second. You lay down the bunt there, fine, whatever. I can get there with it, even though, you know, it harms slightly your chances of having a big inning and putting this game completely out of reach. So runners on first and second, nobody out. They sack bunt. They end up getting nothing. 9th inning rolls around. Danny Jensen leads off with a double. And this is where we enter the rare situation where, and people will tweet at you about this on Twitter and not believe you, but the data or analytics, the boogeyman, whatever, you actually says, yeah, you know what? Lay that bunt down. Free of context. So what I mean by free of context is, if all we know is the Blue Jays score at this rate, the Guardians score at this rate, it's a tie game, it's the bottom of the 9th, there is a runner on second and nobody out. That's all the information we have. The numbers slightly favor bunting there. A successful bunt would improve your win expectancy from 81.1% to 82.7%. So you get a 1.6% bump laying that bunt down. Now, there is a slight ding to Danny Jansen being a slower runner, and you don't have options at this point because 2 of your players have left hurt, and you've used a pinch runner for Davis Schneider in the previous inning to score what was at that point a game-tying run. So you have nobody on the bench you can turn to as a pinch runner. The math gets a slight ding because Danny Jansen is slightly slower. That means your chances of a successful bunt are slightly less. His chances of moving up from third on a wild pitch are slightly less. His chances of scoring on a sac fly are slightly less. The math still kind of tilts in the favor of do it here, even with Danny Jansen being a below average runner. Then you look at, okay, well, Kevin Biggio hasn't been asked to bunt very much in his career, especially recently. And, you know, I got a couple questions or tweets about, well, why don't the Jays have their guys coming up practice bunting more? And the honest answer is because most guys who make the major leagues were the top players on their team on the way up. And yes, organizationally, you could hammer your minor league teams with, yeah, even if the guy's hitting third or fourth, if it's a spot that says bunt, we'd like our guys to practice bunting. That's just not, like, in practicality. Kevin Biggio was one of the top hitters on every team he played for on the way up, and there was rarely a situation where it would have made sense for his manager, often John Schneider, to ask one of his best hitters to lay down a bunt. Now, with how Biggio has settled in the major leagues, given what we know about him as, you know, a ball player and a guy who works on everything, etc., maybe you have a little more faith than the numbers say, but he only has 2 sacrifice bunts his entire major league career. In addition to that, Kevin Biggio is a dead pull hitter. So if you're thinking about scenarios where he's allowed to swing, probably the biggest concern is that he strikes out there, you burn an out, and it's not a productive one. But if he puts the ball in play, generally Kevin Biggio hits the ball far enough to advance Jansen or puts it on the ground in a way that the runner on second could still advance to third. There are a couple of different ways. Elliot Friedman is in the studio here. Are you going to join us?
I need you to talk me off the ledge. I've been watching the Jays since I got back. How are you gonna help us here, Blake?
I'm not.
You're our master psychologist or psychiatrist.
Yeah. It's not good. I think the biggest thing leaving you confident right now is that the Texas Rangers are doing everything they possibly can to fall out of a playoff spot.
Yeah.
They've lost like a million games in a row. Mm-hmm. You're about to play 4 pretty bad teams in a row.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel great about it, though. I'm Full disclosure, I don't feel great right now.
You're a terrible psychologist. You are maybe the worst psychologist I think I've ever met.
Well, I don't think a psychologist's job is to just lie to you and tell you everything's going to be okay, right? They got to be honest with you, and if there's stuff you got to work on, they got to nudge you toward working on it, right?
Yeah, you know, I was overseas. I didn't watch a lot the last couple weeks, but I always buy my playoff tickets. You know, I love the Jays. I can say this because I don't cover them. I love the Jays. I love watching them. And then I come back and, oh, it's depressing.
It is. And they're 2.5 games back for anyone who hasn't checked the standings today.
Yeah.
Texas, again, Spyro Seattle now leads the AL West. So the Jays are only 2.5 back. If you were looking for positives, you'd lay them out this way. Hey, Davis Schneider was another boost on the weekend. Yes. Maybe you've got a guy there. Your pitching staff has been one of the best three in all baseball. The Nats are really hot lately, but they're here and they're in fourth place in the NL East.
Yeah.
And then you've got three last place teams in a row. This is absolutely the time where you could go on a run and stack some wins against bad teams and catch up a little bit.
Was it Buck who said the other day they got to go 12-3 or they're doomed?
Yeah, and they went 1-2 to start that stretch. Yeah, so now it's what, 11-1?
When Buck comes out and says that, that's like the 5-alarm blaze.
Yeah, and if we are to hold Buck to that, they now have to go 11-1 over the next.
Are the Royals 12. The last place team?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, because I'm going to one of those.
Royals are last place. Rockies are last place. They play another bad team in there somewhere as well. And then Washington was in last place, but they're on a heater right now.
Oh, great. Just perfect timing.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
How's your summer been?
It's been this.
Yeah.
It's been, it's the rare day. None of the World Cup games are particularly close right now in FIBA. So I don't have any of the games on in here.
And Canada's playing again tomorrow.
Yes. Yeah. And that one's at 9:30. So we'll have that one on in here and I'll be doing my best to pay attention to both things. Dan Schulman doing
well.
Schulman
can do two games. The least you can do is pay attention.
Yeah,
you know, I always loved Shea. I've got a Shea T-shirt at home.
Nice,
but I'll tell you, I've become a big Dylan Brooks fan.
It's he's one of those guys, and we run into this. And I mean, it was the entire ethos of the Leafs offseason.
Yeah,
you hate that guy when he's on another team, but when he's on your team, it feels a lot different to have that agitator, right?
I know it got a little crazy with him last year. I can't follow it all the time, but I think he sets a tone. I really do. I watch him out there, and in hockey, they say it's like who drags you into the fight. Like that guy drags you into the fight. I know everybody's excited about the Canada basketball. And it looks phenomenal, but we've seen this movie before. I actually want to see it happen.
We've seen the movie before.
I get excited.
But they got the game they normally choke in, they got out of the way first, which is
France.
They destroyed France. Usually it's, hey,
I guess France was the one who had the big choke this week.
Yeah, and then lost to Latvia as well.
Yeah.
So
Porzingis isn't even playing?
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, hey, that game tomorrow, Canada-Latvia, both teams are already moving on, but that's not a pushover team. They're tough and they got a lot of shooters, and where France rolled over for Canada once Canada put it on, I don't think Latvia is going to do that.
I don't think they're going to do that.
So that'll
be a lot of good stuff.
Yeah. Which Royals game are you going to?
The Friday night one.
Nice.
Yeah. The Friday night one. I wonder how much carnage Arash is creating in Indonesia right now.
I think he's okay right now. As long as Canada's... I feel like Arash would be at risk of creating carnage if Canada were playing poorly.
Yeah.
Because he'd be miserable and that would bleed over.
No, he's miserable all the time.
Or if Canada wins, he will create carnage because he'll be, you know, insufferable down there. And
he's miserable and insufferable all the time.
Yeah. Honestly, for him, it's just got to be nice for him to not have to pay attention to his Minnesota Vikings leading into this season.
I'm a Vikings fan, too.
Oh, you are, too?
Oh, yeah. I was watching Cousins on the quarterback
still
show.
Kirk Cousins, eh?
Yeah, I love, like, he's tried to be like Mr. Clean Cut nice guy, and now he's got that horrible Fu Manchu mustache. Maybe it'll work for him this year.
You've messed around with the big sideburns, long hair, and stuff. We could see
to just change up the look. Like, it's important. Change up the look, change up the attitude.
I mean, the only Blue Jay playing well right now is a guy with a big mustache, so.
Yes, that's a good point, actually. See? We figured it out.
There you go.
Blake, keep killing it, man. You're doing a great job. Been listening.
Thanks for stopping in, man.
My pleasure.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
As Elliot Friedman, nice little surprise. He'll be down at the Royals game next Friday, and if you are the Blue Jays, you are hoping that you are on a heater at that point. because, again, you're playing some pretty bad teams in a row here. You are dealing with a Nationals team right now that was last place a couple days ago. They've won 11 of 15. You're then going to play the Rockies and the Athletics and the Royals, who are all last place teams. And nobody is going to feel better about the Blue Jays' chances of beating playoff teams because they beat up on some cellar dwellers. But you got to get there, first of all, and this is their best chance in the schedule to make a little bit of a run. Here's some context for you about the Jays' inability to make a run this year. They only have one winning streak of five games or longer. They won six in a row at one point. And yes, if you win three out of every four games, you'd finish the season with a 750 winning percentage. You'd set the record for wins in a season. You don't have to do it in streaks. But for context, last year they had three such streaks. In 2021, they had four such streaks. They had four in 2015 when they made that big run late in the season. Even in the lean years from 2017 to 2020, they had at least one of these streaks every year, often two. This Blue Jays team has not done what most good teams in Toronto or elsewhere have been able to do, which is rip off a run where you look like the best team in baseball for a week or two. We haven't seen that from the Blue Jays at all, and it's not everything, but when you look at good seasons at the end of the year, or often even mediocre ones, they tend to include a stretch of a week or two, sometimes multiple stretches, where that team looks like the best team in baseball. And the Blue Jays haven't looked like that at all, and they didn't look like that against the Cleveland Guardians. To round out our thought before Elliot came in, going through the math of that Biggio sacrifice bunt. So context-free, the math says, yeah, actually bunt here slightly. Then you give it a ding because Jansen's a slightly slower base runner. You give it a ding because Kevin Biggio's chances of advancing the runner without a sacrifice bunt are pretty good because he's such a pull hitter and the runner's on second base already. Then you give it back a slight boost because Biggio's a swing and miss guy. Anyway, then you look ahead at Santiago Espinal being up next. He is a contact guy. So again, this is where there's confounding factors. If it were a fast runner on the bases, you'd probably lean more toward, yep, bunt at the third because Espinal's a high contact guy and that guy can go contact play and take off on a ground ball. But Santiago Espinal, even though he's not a super high K guy, is not a productive outs guy generally. I know he had a couple of long fly balls in Saturday's game to productive outs that way. But anyway, the way all of this shakes out is that the math still says slightly to bunt there. I know a lot of people don't like the bunt. I didn't like the call to bunt. I think Biggio is a guy you trust to at least pull the ball. And yeah, we're obviously splitting hairs here. We're talking about 81.1% versus 82.7%. But I got asked a lot about the math, so there is the math. Anyway, rolls around, 10th inning. Jays have obviously a runner on second, nobody out, and they're not able to do anything with it there. 11th inning rolls around. The Blue Jays have nobody left in the bullpen. If you are looking at that game, Jordan Romano had already thrown 36 pitches. Jordan Hicks, Jimmy Garcia, Tim Mesa, and Yenesis Cabrera had all pitched. Trevor Richards had given you multiple innings the day prior. So while you probably could have used him, that's an emergency situation. Your last options are Jay Jackson and Bowden Francis. Jay Jackson gets lit up in the 11th. It happens. It's the last guy in your bullpen, the guy fresh up from AAA. This is the cost of not doing things earlier and letting the game get to where it got. The Jays add one in the 11th, but it's too late at that point. They have lost. Adding insult to injury, Noah Syndergaard, who they got five runs off of, but who was able to last six innings and who gave the Blue Jays fits last time they saw him, gets designated for assignment immediately after the game. So a little kick of the dirt in the scrape there. Let's zoom out again, because that the specifics of that game were very frustrating at a couple points, and I'm sure you all have your instance that you were most frustrated by, your coaching decision that you were most frustrated by. We dust off our Sun Tzu Art of War, but war acronymed wins above replacement there. You can pick at a couple of different things there. The zoom out for the game is that you're supposed to be significantly better than the Cleveland Guardians. You had multiple chances to win that game on the way, whether it's getting to Noah Syndergaard even earlier and getting into an overworked bullpen over the last 4 days, whether it is executing in the seventh and the ninth when you had big opportunities, whatever the case. each one of these micro decisions we are picking apart, and they're worth picking apart. That's the fun part of baseball, and these situations are going to come up in playoff games. My answer in this specific game is you shouldn't have been in that position in the first place. If you are significantly better than the Cleveland Guardians, which you are supposed to be, and you had multiple opportunities to blow that game open early, to add insurance runs at one point, to win this game walk-off fashion earlier, you shouldn't have to be in a spot where you're deciding between Jay Jackson and Bowden Francis and deciding who is the better leverage option to extend that game. You shouldn't be in a situation where, I mean, look, some of the bench stuff, it wasn't their fault. Bo Bichette and Matt Chapman came out of the game hurt. That forces your hand with bench choices. Alejandro Kirk was the only guy left on the bench, and you're not putting him into bunt. You're not putting him into pinch run. I get it. Even the Davis Schneider pinch run, where Kevin Kiermaier pinch ran for him, and that run ends up coming across, you can nitpick that one. But at that point in time, the Blue Jays are playing to win that game there. I can at least understand that one. If everyone does their job a little better, you're not getting to those niche spots in the game anyway. And that would be my biggest takeaway, is you shouldn't be playing so many tight games with the Cleveland Guardians like this, because you're supposed to be much better than them. That's the zoom out at the game level. You zoom out at the series level, you shouldn't have been in a spot where you're trying to just salvage a win of the series because you once again couldn't hit off this team at all on Friday. You zoom out on the season, and you shouldn't be in a place where Buck Martinez is saying, if you win, you have to win 12 of the next 15 or you're toast in the playoff race, because you should have taken care of business at a bunch of different junctures in the season. And that's where the frustration certainly sets in at the team level. I think we've heard John Schneider swear a couple times now, not child friendly, not radio friendly. We can't play those clips, John. Look, there is an obvious frustration with him. There's an obvious frustration with the team. We've heard a couple of the pitchers mention it. None of the guys look particularly happy about how things are going. And this is the cascading effect of, look, all games are equal in the standings at the end, but you do more of your work earlier, you don't have to deal with an entire September ahead here where everything feels urgent and everything feels must win. And mathematically, that's not the case yet, but it's starting to feel that way. The Blue Jays entered Friday's play with a 59.8% chance of making the playoffs based on Fangraphs playoff odds. Those are not everything, but to highlight how bad a weekend this was, they dropped from 59.8% to 48.5%. So you have dipped below the 50% mark, and now in terms of the likelihood that you'll make the playoffs. And why that is the case is because the teams around you, with the exception of Texas, kept winning. You look at the American League standings, the Baltimore Orioles are 10 and a half games ahead of the Blue Jays. So put that one completely out of your mind at this point. The Tampa Bay Rays are 6 games up for the number one wildcard spot. And Seattle, the hottest team in baseball for the last little bit, the team that was on your tail, have actually done so well that they've jumped Houston and Texas in the division. And it's now Houston and Texas you're fighting with. And maybe it makes you feel a little bit good that Texas has been so irredeemably bad for these last couple weeks. But they haven't been bad enough for you to make up serious ground. You're sitting here 2.5 games out of a wild card spot with 30 to go. And yeah, suddenly a series against the Washington Nationals at home with Gausman, Berríos, and Bassett on the hill, it feels like a big deal that the Nationals have won more games lately than they've lost, because you were so relying on 4 straight series against last place teams to give you a little boost here. Anyway, we'll see how Arden Zwelling feels about that in the 11 o'clock hour. He's going to join us in here for the entire hour in studio. Couple of minor updates from around the weekend before we get to a break and talk to David Schoenfield of ESPN. Matt Chapman left that game on Sunday. His right middle finger is still dealing with inflammation and soreness there. He is headed for an MRI. This is something that's persisted for a couple weeks now, even with a handful of days off. Have to wonder if maybe the MRI is going to say you should probably not be throwing a baseball and catching a baseball and squeezing a baseball bat and using it to hit projectiles while your finger heals. And maybe he takes a 10-day sit. We'll see. Bo Bichette is said to be day-to-day. That's a quad issue that's been nagging him a little bit. They call this precautionary. They say it's unrelated to the patella issue that put him on the IL before. You kinetic chain folk and biomechanic people will know that knee injuries and hip injuries tend to have impact on other body parts, quads, thighs, backs, things like that. It might be unrelated in an acute fashion of, hey, his knee hurt and then he hurt his quad, but it seems like it's probably not completely unrelated. If you're looking at who might come up for one of those guys, Addison Barger and Aurelvis Martinez remain at AAA. Ernie Clement can fill in all around the diamond. Maybe you move Whit Merrifield back to the infield. Nathan Lucas comes up. Spencer Horwitz had an 8-hit weekend for Buffalo. I don't know where you'd play him, but maybe if the plan is, hey, David Schneider's going to play pretty much every day now, we need another bench bat, you could do something with that. He's been up before, but again, as a guy who only really plays first base and hasn't blown people away in his rare second base and left field opportunities, he's probably just a bench bat for you. Regardless, at least he's hitting well. The other note, especially if you look at, well, Jay Jackson came up, he got shelled, maybe you need a fresh arm in the bullpen. Chad Green pitched Saturday and Sunday. He finally cleared the back-to-back hurdle. He has, I think, 11 or 12 rehab appearances underneath him now. The velocity's still not popping, but the results have been really, really good for Chad Green down there from a walk, strikeout, ERA perspective. So maybe you give him a look. You do have a 40-man spot open because of the Paul DeJong DFA, and yeah, you have a path to him rejoining. We thought maybe they'd put that off for Friday when rosters expand by two players, but if they need to do some bullpen churn, wouldn't be entirely surprising. Alec Manoah is also in AAA now, but he's not listed as a probable pitcher. We don't know when he's going to pitch. He is maybe only there in spirit. We'll talk to Arden Zwelling about that at 11 o'clock as well. As we look ahead, Kevin Gausman against Josiah Gray tonight, Jose Berríos against Mackenzie Gore tomorrow, and the afternoon series decider on Wednesday, Chris Bassitt against Patrick Corbin. Again, Nats very, very bad for most of the year. Have won 11 of their last 15, so maybe not the best time to catch them. Strength of schedule is fluid. Quality of competition is fluid. And as Joe Siddle always reminds you, and as was very, very clear this weekend, strength of schedule doesn't matter if you are playing bad baseball. The Blue Jays continue to do that. We'll see if, with the benefit of not living through it day to day, things feel a little bit differently. David Schoenfield had the Blue Jays still in the mix in the American League at last writing, but on the outside looking in from an American League power rankings perspective. We'll check in with him about how the national view is of this Toronto Blue Jays team, of this American League wildcard race, and we'll zip around the weekend that was in Major League Baseball. David Schoenfield next on Jays Talk Plus on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Sportsnet Radio Network, and Sportsnet 360.
Discussing the biggest stories that matter to Toronto sports fans. The Fan Morning Show with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. A tough weekend for the Toronto Blue Jays as they fall to 2.5 games back of the wild card. A team that's probably had a tougher weekend, and maybe the only team that could argue they've had a tougher August here in terms of how it's affected their playoff standing, is the Texas Rangers, who dropped three of four, to the Minnesota Twins. Dropped a whole lot of games lately. I just tried to count on the schedule. They're going through it here. They have lost 9 of their last 10. They've fallen out of the division. They're now probably the team that the Toronto Blue Jays are targeting most in the American League wildcard race. If you were looking at ESPN last week and you're reading senior MLB writer David Schoenfield, you would have seen a list of what every would-be or potential contender needs to be doing over this stretch run. And neither the Texas Rangers nor the Toronto Blue Jays are doing that. David Schoenfield joins us now. Good morning. How are you, man?
Good morning, Blake. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm better than they're doing on Texas radio this morning, I think. I guess let's start with that side of the American League wildcard race, because, I know you and Jeff Passan last week still on the ESPN power rankings, you know, we're like, hey, Texas will probably pull this out in the West. They have the best offense in the American League. They just need to shore up the one game loss stuff. They did themselves a bit of a favor by getting blown out to oblivion on Friday, but again on Sunday, they're right back to losing one run games. What's going on with the Texas Rangers? Should they be the team maybe that the Blue Jays have in their crosshairs for, hey, who's most realistic to catch up to here?
Yeah. I mean, it looks like that right now. Yeah. Speaking of Texas radio, I was on there late last week when they were still in first place by a game, and they were already asking if this is a collapse. And I said, well, you do have the wild card to fall back on, but that race is so tight. Yeah, they blew another game yesterday. They had moved Aroldis Chapman in as the closer to replace the struggling Will Smith, and he promptly blew a lead in the ninth, and they lost in extra innings. The offense, which, you know, was so dominant all year, they're obviously scuffling this month. So, yeah, look, we've all been around baseball long enough, and we know when you get into these droughts, they can be really hard to break out of. You know, the pressure starts mounting, some injuries, you know, the pitching struggles. So, yeah, I'm kind of with you. If I'm the Blue Jays, who are you most likely to catch? It does look like Texas right now.
So on the Blue Jays side, you mentioned there, sometimes when a team hits a drought, it's hard to pull out of, and it's only once it's happened for a couple games that you can exhale. The Toronto Blue Jays are in a bit of a mode lately where they only really score once a week, and they score in bunches then. Yeah. What you wrote about at ESPN for what the Blue Jays need to do here between now and October is that they need to find some mojo on offense. Now, they scored a little bit more on the weekend here in only taking one of three, but you know, from the national point of view, what is your read on this Blue Jays offense and why they haven't been able to put it together?
Yeah, I know. I keep waiting for, you know, Vladdy to go on a tear, and obviously they missed Bo Bichette. And I know, you know, the reconfigured stadium is hurting their offense a little bit. You know, they've been better on the road than at home. But, what, they're ninth in the league in runs, you know. And at this point, it's late August. This is probably what they are. They're just a mediocre offensive team despite all the big names, you know. So are they still capable of a last-month tear? Well, yeah. I mean, the upcoming schedule is going to help in theory, right? Colorado and Oakland and what, Kansas City after mm-hmm. they play the Nationals. So, look, clearly they got to tear through that schedule. You know, I've watched a lot of Royals lately because I was watching them play the Mariners. They're terrible. You know, you got to at least take two out of three in that series. You got to go into Colorado and Oakland and maybe take five out of six. And then you're really putting the pressure on Texas because that series with the Rangers follows that easy part of the schedule.
Yeah, this is Samad Taylor erasure when you're talking about how the Royals aren't very good. Blue Jays prospect legend. We're rooting for him. But yeah, that team's very, very bad. I'm watching them closely as the Mariners took 3 of 4 against them and the Royals almost came through with a split for the Blue Jays. You know, that certainly looks to be the case with Colorado, with Oakland, with Kansas City. They are catching Washington on a bit of a heater here. Do you see much in what Washington's done lately with this 11 of 15 stretch, or just kind of the random lulls of the dog days? Someone has to win some games.
No, I think they're 26 and 15 going back to whatever that date is. I just read that this morning. You don't look at that roster and say, yeah, they're not that good, but clearly the last month or so, they have played well. So that's not a gimme series, no doubt. You know, a lot of young players on the Nationals, but they're rebuilding, showing some positive signs. Davey Martinez, you know, I think he's one of the better managers. He has that team probably playing above their talent level, you know, so you can't overlook them for sure.
So with the Blue Jays, and you mentioned it there a little bit, you're kind of just waiting for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. to, you know, have an offensive hot streak or something like that. You wrote back in spring training, you did this piece for ESPN about the most intriguing player for 2023 on each team. And Vladimir Guerrero Jr. was your choice for the Blue Jays, not because, you picked the best player because they are always fascinating, but because he had this up and down stretch heading into this season where, yeah, he on the come up, he flashed some stuff. He looked pretty good, had the huge first half of 2021 and then cooled off a little bit in 2022. He has had even a lesser season here than he had last year. You were unsure of who the real Vladimir Guerrero Jr. was heading into this year. Does this make you more confused as to who the real version of him is? Or is this, you know, a convincing data point that he's a good, not great, maybe player?
Yeah, I would say a little confused. I don't know what the word is there in Toronto to explain. And you hate to say struggles, that's a little unfair, but compared to what he did in 2021 at such a young age. We certainly expected more monster seasons like that, and we haven't seen it the last 2 years. Although I think it's worth, this is maybe an off-season piece for me to investigate. You know, 2019 and then 2021 to a lesser extent were sort of the juiced ball years. And I think we're going to go back and find out there were a lot of guys that had sort of fluky numbers in either 2019 or 2021 compared to what they did the rest of their careers. Now, does that fit Vlad? I don't know. Last time I checked, a lot of his, you know, Statcast data, the exit velocity, stuff like that, it's not really all that different from 2 years ago. So I'm not sure why the power is down so much. I'd have to check his ground ball rate if, you know, the plate discipline I know hasn't been quite as good, but I know for Blue Jays fans, there's got to be a high level of frustration at his numbers.
Certainly there is. And, you know, it's been a common talking point here, and we'll get texts into the text line or callers in or whatever, and people disagree pretty dramatically on it, but the numbers are the numbers. He had two homers on the weekend, but still we're looking at a guy with, an OPS around 785 right now, who was, you know, OPS over 1,000 2 years ago. It's been a frustrating go. So, David, within this piece of what every MLB contender needs to do from here to October, I'd like to go back to it because in addition to the Jays and the Rangers, you had a couple of, obviously, the Blue Jays AL East compatriots in there. The Orioles were top of the list for you, and you had mentioned, you know, specifically making sure Grayson Rodriguez gets to the playoffs still able and ready to pitch. When you look at that team and they're running a six-man rotation, they have another starter that they're converting to a short-term reliever in Tyler Wells. They have John Means on the way back. When a team has such good starting pitching depth, but no obvious candidates for, like, okay, who's starting game one, game two, game three, how do you manage that both down the stretch and, you know, if we look ahead to a playoff series, what do you make of how the Orioles might handle that?
Yeah, look, there's no doubt. You look at that rotation on paper and it doesn't blow you away. Kyle Bradish has been their best pitcher. And he's underrated, 3.03 ERA, you know, pretty good strikeout rate. You know, certainly he's not a dominant, you know, kind of the way you view an ace, you know, but in this day and age, 3.03 ERA, that's pretty good. But yeah, after that, Kyle Gibson, Dean Kramer, these guys don't scare you. Grayson Rodriguez, the rookie, was really bad the first 2 months, went back down. He's been pretty good since he came up. But yeah, this team relies on the bullpen. We know that's their strength in pitching. The problem there, their all-star closer, Felix Bautista, just went on the IL. I don't know. I haven't seen any updates. It didn't sound very promising, you know, as far, you know, elbow soreness, you know, this late in the year. Is he going to come back? And that's a big blow. This guy's been probably the best reliever in baseball this year, you know, 8-2. 33 saves. We know the stuff is just lights out. So that's a big problem for them. You know, they have depth. You know, Yennier Cano presumably takes over as closer. But, you know, we all know that ripple effect. You lose one guy and everybody else gets pushed up. And, you know, so many of those roles are different. So, yeah, the Orioles on paper, even though they have the best record in the AL, you still they look beatable to me in October.
I agree with you, and it's, you know, they took 10 of 13 games against the Blue Jays this year, so maybe this show is not the right spot for me to say, yeah, I think the Orioles have some weaknesses. But yeah, and Felix Bautista, anytime the term UCL comes up in, you know, elbow discomfort or whatever as well,
yep,
it's obviously concerning there. The Red Sox are still kind of on the periphery of this as well. And they're, you know, 4.5 games out of the wild card. But if we're saying the Jays are in the mix at 2.5 out, then we probably have to consider the Red Sox in the mix at 4.5 out. Are you surprised at all that they've been able to, despite not really pushing anything in at the trade deadline to fortify, that they've been able to hang around this race and play good enough baseball to hang in a pretty competitive wild card environment?
Yeah, no, for sure. Mainly, you know, because they've had so many injuries in the rotation, although I think it's probably the healthiest it's been all year. So, yeah, again, good offense. They've hung in there. I know, yeah, they're in the race, but you got to jump over Toronto, then you got to jump over one of the other teams from the AL West. So the odds are against them, but you know, they've hung in there. They've given themselves a chance. But this is the old school part of me. I always look at rotations. And I know starters only go five innings and the bullpens are almost as important. But you look at that Boston rotation and you wonder, can they really string together another month of good baseball? I'm just not completely sold on that happening.
I'm not sold on it either, but, you know, short windows of time, you never know. I thought the Rays were maybe done rotation-wise too, and they keep chugging along. So the National League side of that piece, David, and not just the piece, just in general here, it has felt for a little while now, like in the National League, and weird stuff happens in the playoffs, but on paper and the way we can evaluate right now, it's the Braves, the Dodgers, and then it's everyone else. And the Dodgers have done a good job getting hot and at least putting some pressure on the Braves to make sure they lock up the top seed. Do you think that is a fair tiering of the National League situation, that it's those two teams, and if it's not them in the NLCS, it would have been a pretty big upset on the way?
Yeah, I mean, you got to rank it that way, you know, but as we know, I hate to say it, it's a cliche, anything can happen. You know, in the Phillies, I would not want to play this team in October. We saw what happened last year. They were the number six seed, and they go to the World Series. Same kind of team. They're not going to win the division, not going to come close to winning the division, but veteran offense that can get hot. Zach Wheeler, to me, I view him as an ace, you know, to lead that pitching staff. In their bullpen, which kind of got hot last October, has been better in the regular season this year. But my sleeper team, and maybe this is just in the moment, the Brewers. 8 straight wins, typical Brewers team. They don't score any runs, but they don't make mistakes. They don't beat themselves. And if they have a lead, they close it out. Devin Williams, you know, he's been right up there with Bautista as one of the best closers in the game. And with Corbin Burnes, you have a guy that hasn't had his best year, but certainly he's been a Cy Young winner. He can get hot. Brandon Woodruff was hurt most of the year. He's back. And Freddie Peralta has been red hot. So you roll those three guys out in a series and you have a chance. So the NL, I'm with you, Braves, Dodgers, but don't overlook the Brewers and the Phillies.
Yeah, and I don't know if the Brewers would do this just for the long-term implications, but Aaron Ashby's on a rehab assignment now, and I look at their bullpen, I'm like, huh, you had another lefty in there, a young, even if it's just to kind of get him some work down the stretch, they become pretty interesting. Some struggles hitting the ball at times. Our old pal Rowdy Tellez, no longer an everyday guy as those numbers came down to earth, but it's a fascinating one there. So at the top of this National League, if we're looking Braves and Dodgers, something interesting has happened over the last couple days. And David, I know that you guys at ESPN kind of did your two-thirds of the way there award watch check-in a couple of weeks ago now, and for the first time, and this isn't everything, but the betting markets no longer have Ronald Acuna Jr. as the favorite to win the NL MVP. It's basically a pick'em between him, Mookie Betts, and Freddie Freeman. What do you make of that race? And obviously standings wise, both of those teams are pretty locked in. They're going to be fine. If you had a vote, or if you do have a vote, how much comes down to, you know, who has the kind of best September here for their respective top team?
Yeah, it's a real fascinating race because, yeah, Acuna's been the clear favorite ever since he broke out early in the year, you know, but I'm looking at Baseball Reference. Yeah, Mookie has passed him in WAR. Fairly significant advantage, 7.4 to 6.3. And we know voters pay a lot more attention to that than they did, you know, even 5 years ago. The advantage for Acuna is he's got that stolen base total that looks flashy, 59 steals. He's going to be the first ever 30-60 guy. Maybe he ends up 30-70. So that looks awesome, right? You know, doing something we've never really seen before. But, you know, the stolen bases, they're valuable, but they're not super valuable. And then you got to factor in Mookie Betts, better right fielder. But not only that, he's played second base. He's played shortstop, and the metrics say he's been very good at those two positions. So that's sort of a hidden value just filling in for the problems the Dodgers had at those positions. So will voters factor that in? I don't have a vote, but I would factor that in. And the offensive numbers now are pretty even. I think if I had a vote right now, I would go Mookie 1, Acuna 2.
I wonder, too, how the way that that lays out, and I know you wrote last week about how the Giants are still in this wild card mix, even though, I mean, you didn't phrase it this way, but I will. Their top position player is 41st in wins above replacement in the National League alone. They have done this without any real contribution from the start. I wonder, does that nudge you a little further in, you know, Logan Webb's candidacy in the NL Cy Young when you compare him to, say, Zach Gallen or, you know, Blake Snell, who's on a team that is, I think we can finally put a pin in their wild card chases.
Yeah, I mean, both Cy Young races look like they're pretty wide open. I can't admit to having studied them super in depth. We do know Cy Young race is certainly less dependent on where the team finishes or what you have around you. MVP, no doubt, if it's close, if you have two guys, the guy who makes the playoffs usually has a little bit of an edge, where Cy Young, that doesn't historically seem to be a factor. I think Gallen is probably the slight favorite right now, but I don't say that with any degree of certainty.
Okay, before I let you go here, David, obviously in the American League, we have a pretty good idea that Shohei Ohtani is going to win Most Valuable Player. We don't really have a good idea, though, of how another UCL injury for him heading into what we expect to be maybe the biggest free agency in baseball history from a dollar amount. We don't know how that is going to impact things necessarily. What is your read, having let it settle for about a week here, on, you know, should we recalibrate Shohei Ohtani's market? Does 550 become, you know, 450 or something like that? Or is it still too much of an unknown because, you know, all it takes is one highest bidder? What do you make of Shohei Ohtani's injury heading into the walk year?
Yeah, I think it's really, really hard to know. First, obviously, we got to see what happens. Will he have surgery? Will he just try to rehab and, you know, come back next year? We don't know. So if he has the surgery, obviously that will affect his value. You know, you're going to lose 1 year of pitching, and then, well, he's got to come back from a second Tommy John surgery. Pitchers have done it. You know, Nathan Eovaldi has done it. Walker Buehler is trying to come back from his second, you know, but there's no guarantee there. So I'm kind of with my colleague Buster Olney, who suggested it seems logical that you would see a contract that's going to guarantee him X amount as a hitter, maybe $300 million just for his ability to be the best hitter in the game that he's been this year. And then pitching, you know, that side of the deal will be heavily weighted towards incentives, game started, innings pitched, that kind of thing. So maybe he could still get up to a $500 million contract if he stays healthy. And then I suppose there's a possibility where he and his agent are like, let's do a 2-year deal, 1 year where he's a DH. He comes back in 2025 as a two-way player, shows he's healthy, has a great year, and goes back into the market. Would he be willing to take less, you know, long-term money to do that? Who knows? So it's to me, the free agency is just as fascinating as it was 10 days ago.
Yeah, there are certainly more term possibilities now than it seemed before the arm injury, and he just turned 29. So even if you do the 2-year, you know, you're looking at free agency at 31. I think you're still getting a pretty good long-term deal at that point. David Schofield, ESPN MLB senior writer, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning, man. I appreciate it.
Yep, thanks for having me.
David Schofield, ESPN MLB senior writer, a lot of good stuff helping us set up these playoff races over at MLB.com. Of late, again, Jays 10.5 back in the division, not great. Texas Rangers, now the team we're talking about in the wild card mix, because the Seattle Mariners have passed them by a game in the American League West. The Minnesota Twins, nice and comfortable in the AL Central, despite the Blue Jays' best efforts to help the Guardians stay and get back in that race. Jays 2.5 back of Texas and Houston for the wild card. They will try to right the ship and start making up some ground tonight down at Rogers Center, 7:00 game, Kevin Gausman against Josiah Gray. Let's take a break. When we come back, Arden Zwelling will join us in studio for the hour. We'll go over the weekend. We'll set up this little run ahead. We'll talk September call-ups. But most importantly, if you were watching the game yesterday, you would have heard Arden give a little bit of a taste of how excited Yusei Kikuchi was to get to talk to Mitchell Hooper, the world's strongest man, who was at the game and threw out the first pitch. We go deep on strongman stuff with the strongman himself, Arden Zwelling, as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL, the J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Joining me in studio, Arden Zwelling of Sportsnet, of sportsnet.ca. Arden, a frustrating weekend results-wise, but not a weekend light on entertainment around the Blue Jays, not light on things to talk about, not light on celebrity sightings down at Rogers Center. The definition of celebrity, maybe a little different person by person, but yeah, how you doing? How was the weekend?
Good. Yeah, that would be like, if I could name a wrestler, I would name them, and I'd be like, that would be like if you ran into your favorite wrestler.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to Jay Jackson on the show about wrestling the other day because when he played in Japan, he was like friends with a bunch of the wrestlers.
There you go.
But yeah, it was like
if you ran into some like esoteric Japanese wrestler at work.
Kazuchika Okada was at a Blue Jays game earlier in the year. I just didn't run into him personally. And yeah, I mean, people probably, there are certainly some people who, as this started, probably thought I was going to talk about Kevin from The Office being at the game yesterday, but we're not, of course. We're talking about Mitchell Hooper, the world's strongest man, throwing out a first pitch and palling around. You pick his brain for some tips or what?
I didn't go that far. I just kind of told him that, hey, I'm a really big fan.
Nice.
And it's been really cool following your career. For people who don't know, like, he's from Barrie, Ontario. And he's had a bunch of different kind of lives athletically. Like, he was a golfer for a while, played university football. He was a marathoner for a while, came to powerlifting and strongman really late in his kind of athletic career. I think he's 27 now.
Yeah.
Which is just wild even as it is. But and so he comes to this late, shows up on the strongman scene, and is like just dominating. It's unbelievable. Like, he won the world's strongest man this year, second at the Shaw Classic to Brian Shaw, who the competition is literally named after. And Brian Shaw is like probably the best strongman of all time, certainly the most accomplished. So like and that was his retirement competition as well. So he was winning that no matter what.
Right. So Hooper probably had to just like, oh, I can't lift it. This last deadlift, I can't do it. The legend wins in his retirement competition.
Well, and Mitch like tears his hamstring on day one.
Ugh.
He tore his hamstring on day one. And like on day two, you still got to do a bunch of explosive stuff with your lower half. So like he showed me his hammy at Rogers Center. It does not look good.
Ooh.
He's training around it right now because like Rogue Invitationals are coming up. Like the strongman season continues. But yeah, he's got this great streak of podiuming in strongman. Yeah, he only ended up on the scene like 2 years ago. It's like Damian Warner in decathlon like just kind of showed up, and all of a sudden it was like, whoa, you are dominating.
It's pretty fascinating. The idea of going marathoner to strongman is fascinating, like body wise. The idea of a guy that huge trying to golf is funny. He was part of the coaching staff for the KW Titans of the smaller Canadian basketball leagues too. So he's got a little bit of everything, and that's cool.
He's an exercise kinesiologist.
Like
he has a master's in that. I mean, he has a really impressive academic resume as well. Just an impressive dude all around.
Yeah, that's you were impressed. For anyone who doesn't know, by the way, he was the first Canadian to win the World's Strongest Man final, and he's only the fourth person to double that with the Arnold Classic in the same year. So pretty accomplished already for a guy just getting into this stuff. You were not the only one excited about it. Yusei Kikuchi was pretty fired up about meeting Mitch Hooper.
I had to wait for Yusei to finish talking to him before I could introduce myself. And Yusei was picking his brain for like 20, 25 minutes because Yusei's into this stuff too. Oh, yeah.
I know that Kikuchi's like, I mean, you can see the arms when he's walking around. You've told us about the 300-pitch bullpen sessions. I'm sure he's very into it, but like the 20, 25 minutes of picking brain, Kikuchi's going to come back Jimmy Garcia size next year.
Kikuchi wants Mitch Hooper to train him in the offseason.
Wow.
Like, that's why. Like, they were exchanging numbers. Like, he wants Hooper to help him out because Kikuchi's at, like, a plateau with his deadlift at 550.
Okay.
He really wants to get to 600, and he wants to do it this offseason. It's been a goal for a number of offseasons. He hasn't been able to get there, so he's hoping Mitch Hooper can coach them through. And when you get up to weights like that, I mean, the technique and the breathing, like a lot of little minute things that go into it can help you unlock some things. So I do think that Mitch Huber, who has pulled like over 1,000 pounds in competition, could likely help Yusei Kikuchi with that. But yeah, he's like really into it. And like I bonded with Yusei Kikuchi over it because like you don't run into too many people who are into strength sports. So Yusei and I actually had like a really great conversation about it. And then obviously I told the story on the broadcast, which is wicked as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm already thinking ahead to, you know, if Kikuchi gets to do this, you know, that's a ready-made, that is the Arden's Welling story of Arden's Welling off-season or spring training stories of like I know you're, I don't know, I'm picturing a scenario where you weasel your way into some of these workouts and you're there as well and telling the fly on the wall story. And then off to the side, you're like, also I deadlifted 500, no big deal, while Kikuchi was doing 600.
I'd love to go train with Yusei in Arizona. I'd love to see his like backyard mound set up that he has.
Yeah, you were telling me about this, and he has to rotate, like he can't have a catcher catch 300 pitches and they need the facility space. So he had to build his own.
The workout facility was like, you can't do these bullpens here anymore. More, you say they take 2 hours. We got other guys. So he built a mound in his backyard so he could do it at home. So yeah, I want to see his training set up. I want to train with him. Yeah, I will certainly be following up next spring on whether or not he got the pull that he's looking for.
So there is obviously there's a fun element of this because it's something you're passionate about and Yusei's passionate about, and it's cool to hear about this guy from Midhurst becoming the world's strongest man. But there's also a very real, hey, every Major League Baseball team has strength and conditioning coaches. This guy is a kinesiologist or whatever the specifics of his master's degree are. And there are obviously things that translate from what you're able to do in the gym from a weightlifting perspective to what you're able to do on the field from a baseball perspective. And I use this as a transition point because there were a couple interesting lower body related things from the Blue Jays this weekend. I want to start with the Alek Manoah one. Because, look, there's a lot of weirdness around that situation. We don't know what day he's going to start yet, but apparently he's down in Buffalo now. But one of the things that has come up is that, you know, there's maybe a little bit of a strength imbalance between his legs, and he thought his back was sore, or he not thought, if his back was sore, his back was sore. But there's something in the kinetic chain there and the imbalance muscular-wise or strength-wise that is maybe at the root of it. Now, that's not something we can diagnose, but how much do you figure that will be a big focus of his offseason if you're in his shoes?
Yeah, I think strength and conditioning will definitely be a big focus of his offseason, as it would be in any offseason. And, like, he was dealing with, yeah, some quad issues, like a bit of an imbalance between his quads, and also with a back issue as well. And that's part of what, like, the last 2 weeks were for him, was just getting to the bottom of that and having testing done. And that's, you know, that includes not only imaging, but, like, strength testing and kind of, like, repeating explosive movements and things like that, and just figuring out if there's anything structurally awry. Turned out there were no significant structural concerns, so he was clear to report to AAA Buffalo, he went to Syracuse because that's where the Bisons were. The big thing for him now is going to be getting back off a mound. I don't expect him to be in a game this week, honestly.
Really?
He didn't throw for 2 weeks. His last start was August 10th.
Yeah.
And he didn't throw between August 10th and the date that he reported to the Bisons. So he's got to go through a ramp up process here. He's got to throw a bullpen. And then his first appearance for the Bisons, whenever that may be, don't expect it to be this week. You're looking at 45, 50 pitches,
yeah,
right? Like, and then from there, 65, from there, 80. So that's what like his next several weeks will look like as he tries to just like get back on a mound and continue working on some of the delivery stuff that he was working on prior.
So obviously when Alek Manoah has been at the major league level, he has not pitched at a rotation caliber for a team trying to make the playoffs. And that's why he was optioned down instead of keeping the sixth man or moving someone to the bullpen. I thought at the time, and I think a lot of people probably thought, that he'd go down there and that's your SP6, right? In an emergency, he gets called up. If rosters expand, if there's a doubleheader day and you get a 27th man, etc. Certainly the timeline on this is now different. Do you get the sense that there was some push and pull within the organization about exactly how to handle, like deploy Manoah, whether it was going right down or, you know, obviously you have to take the player's health and best interests in mind, but they didn't IL him, which, you know, if he was hurt, I think he would have pushed for because of service time and, you know, you get your full major league salary instead of the option salary and things like that. What was there some discussion about the best way to have Manoah ready for the major? Like, I guess what I'm trying to get at is, how did they balance, hey, this is what's best for Manoah long term, and, you know, getting him right for potentially an offseason heading into 2024 versus we could potentially need this guy in a playoff race?
Well, I think as soon as a player reports to you that they are dealing with some discomfort and with soreness and with anything that is an impediment on the mound, you want to get to the bottom of that.
2 weeks, though.
Because, well, continuing to pitch through that is not going to be in his best interests or yours, right? It's not going to be to his benefit. So you might as well get to the bottom of it now and figure out what's going on, because maybe there is something more significant that you really need to knock out. Maybe there's a procedure that needs to happen, right? Like, you got to, you know, you got to get to the bottom of something like that. And now that they have, he just resumes trying to get to a point where he can be depth for this team. The Blue Jays want to have Alek Manoah as a depth option because, perhaps you've noticed, not a ton of depth options on the starting pitching side, and bad things happen to starting pitchers.
How dare you? Wes Parsons has been lighting it up for AAA Buffalo. I won't stand for it. But no, you're right. The likeliest scenario is probably Bowden Francis bulks a game and you call up an extra reliever if you have a need for that.
Like, right now, your number six is Bowden Francis.
Yes.
And, like, by merit as well. Even, like, if Alek Manoah honestly was healthy and available, I think Bowden Francis by merit would be your number six as well. Because, look, he throws strikes, commands the zone, doesn't walk anybody. Velocity is there.
Five walks in 27 innings heading into this weekend or something like that.
Velocity is consistent, composed on the mound, controls the game well. I mean, routines, habits, all that stuff is all solid. And he's done it at the big league level. Really good breaking ball. Can turn a lineup over twice. You can stretch him out. So Bowden Francis is your number six. Right now, your number seven is like Trevor Richards for three innings and bullpen it the rest of the way. Unless we want to talk about like adding Zach Thompson to the 40 again. So
didn't they trade him?
Zach Thompson?
Oh no, maybe there were all those rumors that he was going to get dealt. There was a lot around the trade deadline.
Yeah. So and Zach Thompson's had a fine year with AAA Buffalo. Any team could have had him when he was DFA'd and, you know, removed from the 40 man and no team wanted him. I mean, that would be like, that's the level of depth we're talking about right now. That's why the Blue Jays are trying to get Alek Manoah back up and throwing again. But
Mitch White's had two good starts in a row.
You know what?
You ready to believe?
Oh man, I forgot Mitch White.
He's one earned over three and two earned over four.
This is the level of depth we're talking about.
This is
yeah. Why the Blue Jays wanted Alek Manoah to be available.
And why option 1A by a long shot would be, hey, move Bowden Francis into the rotation because you have way more relief pitching options than you have starting options. That took a hit a little bit. We'll stay on kind of the injury stuff here. Eric Swanson hit the IL. I think people see, first of all, him come out of a game, which, given the workload he's had this year, is unusual for him. He's kind of been a workhorse for them. And then they see the term thoracic spine inflammation. That sounds worse than, hey, his back's a little sore. But what did you make of that? I think I saw you tweet that it's possible he could be throwing again within 10 days.
That's the expectation, okay, is that he'll be thrown within 10 days and like out for a rehab appearance within 13 and off the IL.
So missed the minimum.
It's like something that he's been carrying for a little bit, obviously. Like, it was really barking in that outing that we saw him come out of. It's the sort of deal, it was compared to me, sort of like the Trevor Richards issue earlier this month, where it was, he probably needs about 5 to 7 days off. We could carry him and go short in our bullpen, but is that really putting ourselves in the best possible position? We're still far enough away from the finish line that we can, you know, withstand the 15 days without.
And buy him an extra maybe 3-4 days that he would have been trying to pitch through otherwise.
Similar to when Jordan Romano had his back issue for the second time, it was, yeah, he probably needs 5 to 7 days realistically. And it's just right in the middle of that. You know, it's a 15-day
17 and 17 stretch and all that.
Yeah. Or you don't put him on. So, like, instead of trying to kind of, you know, carry him and go short, they decided, all right, put him on the IL. But, yeah, Eric Swanson, I expect to be back with the Blue Jays within 15 days. Mm-hmm. I expect back on a mound within 10.
Nice. So Jay Jackson got the call. Now, there are a couple of guys in Jackson and Bowden Francis and Yenesis Cabrera who still have options here. A couple guys at AAA they could call on if they need. You know, I think they'd like Nate Pearson to get some regularity down with AAA rather than the up and down and stuff there. They'll also get an extra arm on Friday when rosters expand. Chad Green pitched both Saturday and I can't remember if it was Saturday and Sunday or Friday and Saturday, but he pitched back to back on the weekend. And all good. Results continue to be great. He had that one game where he hung a slider to Brett Beatty, and that's it over like 11 or 12 rehab appearances now. we talked about last week, you know, what makes the most sense is you just wait for Friday at this point. Possible as a means of freshening up the bullpen after this weekend that we see him even sooner than that?
It's possible. It kind of depends how the next few days go. Yeah. Like, the optimal way is September 1st. Because right now, if you option Jay Jackson, you can only bring him back without an injury. Like, you got to wait 10, 15 days, mm-hmm. is it, right?
I think it's the 15th, but I'm 15? Not sure if that is loosened for reset. September 1st.
No, I asked on the weekend. It doesn't reset on September 1st. So he'd have to stay on option for 15
days. So it'd be,
days.
You'd then have to, you know, bring up Nate Pearson or whoever on instead.
And Chad Green is not pitching today because I believe the back-to-back was Saturday, Sunday. Okay. So he's not pitching today, no matter what. So really, you are just checking in with him, seeing how he's feeling.
And then you've got an off day Thursday, so you can save the bullpen a little bit there anyway.
You could probably string this out till September 1st. That extra pitcher spot that opens up on September 1st, that's Chad Green's. The extra 40-man
I don't think
spot.
That's any question at this point.
Yeah, that's open. That's Chad Green's. The extra position player spot, that's Nathan Lucas's spot. He's... what I believe. Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, I just took your next question from
Well, no. Well, that was a question, but on the way to that question is, well, what if Bo Bichette and Matt Chapman are more banged up than day-to-day? So Bo Bichette leaves yesterday's game with, and we'll go back to kinetic chain and deadlift stuff here. You come back from a knee injury and then your quad starts barking. I know they said they're not related, but they're probably not, like, unrelated, right?
That was John Schneider speaking after a game, and yeah, he's not an exercise scientist. So,
what did Strongman think when you asked him?
I saw him on Friday, and the Bo thing happened on Sundays. But honestly, Mitchell Hooper would know.
Yeah,
like legitimately would know. But yeah, so I don't know if it's connected or not. I think Bo Bichette's going to be banged up for the rest of the year. I think he's going to be playing with discomfort for the rest of the year.
We saw him get a DH day on the weekend, too, just in case.
Wouldn't be surprised to see some more of those. Like, I think that when you play shortstop every day and you take 650 plate appearances a year, you're going to deal with some soreness and some discomfort. Like, yeah. I think that's part of that gig.
Yeah. And part of what makes him so valuable as a guy who, with the exception of the 2 weeks down this year, has been, I mean, even with that still, I think he'll probably end up at the end of this year, maybe semi and Thompson, but he's going to be like right there for most plate appearances in the American League over the last three seasons. And he'll be first in hits.
And when Bo went down with the patellar tendonitis, what I was told at the time was this is going to be a 3 week deal. Mm-hmm. And he beat that back. It was like 2.5 weeks. He was back to the majors. So, I mean, he's clearly a guy who works incredibly hard, who attacks his rehabs, who takes really good care of himself, who has really good habits, routines away from the field. That's why he's able to play as much as he does. And obviously, like, a great athlete as well. But yeah, I mean, he's going to be banged up the rest of the year, but I don't expect him to go on the IL with this.
Certainly don't want to ding him for, hey, you're playing through some stuff and you haven't been quite yourself at the plate. But in the 8 games since he's returned, 629 OPS, is this something where he's banged up and you'd expect a performance dip, or is this just kind of an 8-game blip because this happens?
It's kind of one of those Bo Bichette streaks, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of with an approach as aggressive as his.
And then he'll have 4 hits tonight or something. And
it happens, right? So, yeah, I expect him to be Bo Bichette the rest of the way. It's that time of year, man. Everybody's carrying something, whether we know about it or not. Everybody on that team has something.
Yeah, I remember the Raptors championship run, and like by the time the finals walked around, like every single person in that locker room looked like they were walking on their tiptoes with like bow legged because everyone had something they were like. Danny Green was like not mobile by that point. So with the Bo Bichette thing, obviously you can't navigate that something else might come up or it might flare up, but we do see again pretty quickly of this idea of, well, you DFA'd Paul DeJong and now your shortstop insurance is Santiago Espinal and giant question mark. Does this change anything? I mean, I don't know if I even ever got to ask you about your opinion about the DeJong DFA versus, you know, hanging around it and massaging that differently. I guess the succession plan is just a lot of Santiago Espinal if Bo is banged up or at some point something comes up.
Yeah, part of the calculus with DeJong being DFA'd was the Blue Jays were reasonably confident that Bo Bichette would be able to play a lot of shortstop the rest of the way. I think that's still the belief. Part of it as well is you are just more invested in a Santiago Espinal and a Davis Schneider beyond this season. Mm-hmm. So it would have been like a pretty tough look to option one of those guys when Paul DeJong was 2 for $1 million.
Three for 44, I think, was the exact number. It's burned into my head.
So, like, that, I don't know how that would have played in your room. And I think that when you're talking about, like, bench guys, you know, edge of the roster guys, I think that that's where the calculus centers of, like, all right, let's do the right thing for our culture and for our team.
By the way, anyone who's still mad about the Paul DeJong thing because he obviously homered in his debut with the Giants, he's 0 for 12 since and has a 37 WRC plus there. So he's not lit the world afire.
The acquisition cost for Paul DeJong at the trade deadline kind of told you everything you needed to know when it's a double-A relief prospect. Like relief prospect, kind of an oxymoron, right? And this is an overage guy at double-A, like doesn't have, you know, stuff that blows you away metrically. And, oh, by the way, also the Cardinals sent you money and covered the options.
Yes.
There are the option buyouts, excuse me. So that kind of told you everything you need to know about, you know, where the value was at.
Yeah. And, I mean, even if a guy like Svonson hits, right, like say he hits next year and he's a piece in a major league bullpen, that versus backfilling a shortstop spot. Yeah, you can understand it even if it didn't work out.
So I do think, the rest of the way, like I do think if Bo Bichette and Matt Chapman are available, which I'd expect them to be, maybe we get some crazy news today.
So that's where I was going to go next was the Matt Chapman thing. Just this right middle finger inflammation flares up again. He had a handful of days off where they used those bookended off days to get him like a significant stretch down. If something is lingering in your middle finger, you could probably play through it, but it's not going to heal. Like that's his throwing finger. That is a finger you use on the baseball bat, and there's a lot, like, that's a lot of pressure on your hands. And also, I don't know if there's causation with the correlation, but he also just hasn't been playing very well around what has been happening here. Do you get the impression that's more serious than the Bo quad thing?
That's going to be something he's going to carry the rest of the year. I'm sure it's going to be a pain tolerance thing, mm-hmm. a discomfort thing. It's not gonna get better by swinging a bat a bunch of times and by throwing a baseball a bunch of times.
And at this point, if it were, I don't know, say the MRI reveals, I guess the MRI wouldn't, an x-ray would, like a small break or something like that, like it's probably something you're just playing through and then resting in the offseason anyway, right?
Players of this time of year will play through broken bones. They'll play through, you know, damaged pulley tendons. Like there's all kinds of, I'm saying generally here,
yes.
Not specifically, generally. Like this is something that we've seen.
You know? Every thoracic spine is inflamed right now.
Well, that's the thing, right? Like you're going to hear about a lot of players having inflammation. Everybody's got inflammation.
Yeah.
We all have inflammation.
You and I do, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you're probably more diligent with the antioxidants and stuff like that, but.
Not quite. So there's all kinds of little contraptions they can give him to make mm-hmm. the bat more comfortable, right?
Like to we saw Vlad's finger taped up,
you
know, when he came out of that game or whatever. We kind of got to look at it at first base, and
he could have kind of like a little ring he can put on his finger that'll create a bit of, you know, leverage between the bat if he's having trouble gripping it, so he just doesn't have to grip as much. Like it's going to be a thing for the rest of the year. But like my point was, provided that Bo Bichette and Matt Chapman are available the rest of the way, I don't get the sense we're going to see an Aurelvis Martinez or an Addison Barger this year, which is where I'm sure this is going. I don't get that sense. I think Nathan Lucas is the extra position player who comes up in September, and I think that Barger and Martinez continue to get regular reps in AAA.
My 1B follow-up to that is, chance it's Ernie Clement instead of Nathan Lucas for the extra infield versatility, or do they have enough with the option to just bump Witt back to the infield?
If Bo Bichette's playing availability changed, you could look at that. I would say right now it's Nathan Lucas. Mm-hmm. The Blue Jays really value like what he does from a plate approach standpoint, the discipline, you don't play him regularly and he still steps in and gives you a great plate appearance.
That was huge the other week.
Right? Defensively.
I mean, we saw this weekend too how nice it would have been to have an extra pinch running option on the
pinch
bench.
Pinch runs well, like solid character guy. So he makes sense. But I mean, is Ernie on the 40?
Question mark.
So if he is, then yeah, you could look at that. But I think, again, that's somebody who keep playing regularly at AAA. If it comes that you need him in September, great. Mm-hmm. But I think Nathan Lucas will be the guy in September 1.
Yeah, and we know that role is not, whoever it is not going to play much, period.
Yeah.
We've already seen this team struggle to, you know, find enough playing time for Davis Schneider, who played a couple days in a row here. I know we'll take a break after this question, but with Davis Schneider's playing time moving forward a little bit, Whit Merrifield's cooled off a little bit. Kevin Biggio, I mean, you still plug him in there, but he's cooled a little bit. Espinal obviously has more defensive utility, but the bat hasn't really come around. Do you see this team trying to, and they did this, to be fair to them, after the Red Sox series, he did play the entire Guardian series. He was 0-for but had 4 walks in that series. And then the playing time kind of went away, even with the homer on the Saturday against Cincinnati. Do you see that being a priority for this next little bit to make sure his bat's in the lineup, even if it means someone you don't want to give as many off days to is subbing out?
Yeah, he's played his way back in, certainly. I haven't looked at the probables for Washington, if there's a lefty in there.
Yes, on Tuesday, Mackenzie Gore. Tuesday,
right. And so tonight it is...
Josiah Gray.
Right, so it's a righty tonight. That'll be interesting to see, right? Because if you have Davis Schneider in, he's your second baseman, your DH, or your left fielder. Yeah.
Patrick Corbin on Wednesday is also a lefty. Okay. So you could potentially sit him today and play him consecutive lefties.
I could see that. I can see him sitting today and playing the next two. He's certainly playing his way into more playing time, as you said. But also, as you said, he did that at Fenway, and then he was like 1-for-14 with some walks,
yeah,
but also with a ton of swing and miss.
Yeah.
So
actually, I did want, so I know you did this on the broadcast. Yeah. You had the heat maps of where pitchers have been attacking him with fastballs. He did some damage against fastballs this weekend. Have you gotten a chance to talk to him or any of the hitting coaches about, obviously, it is a focus if you strike out on high velocity a number of times, but how does he approach working on that? Like, how does a guy get the reps in on pitch types like that?
I absolutely have done that work, and tell me if I'm killing your break by going too deep into it.
No, we're flexible here.
It starts with Hunter Mentz, who's the assistant pitching coach, and he essentially sets up a high velocity pitching machine in the batting cages and has it fire him elevated fastballs every day. So that is partly to refine his swing and get better mechanically at like getting to those pitches, but it's also to help him recognize them, because he'll fire some that are right at the top of the zone, some are a little bit above, some that
are... So you get the brain chunking going on, the pattern recognition stuff.
Exactly. You're trying to see enough of them that you can recognize it in the game, because if it's at the top of the zone or above, Davis Schneider wants to let those go. Even if it's called a strike, you want to let those go, because it's just not a damaged pitch for him. It's not a place that he can really, you know, get a good swing off at. Like, he doesn't get his barrel there. If it's a bit below that, like, shadow zone at the top, that ball width, a bit below, he can hit those. Mm-hmm. And he hit one against Logan Allen on the weekend. So, like, those are ones that he can hit. But he wants to be laying off the ones that are, like, shadow and up. And that gets back to what he's been working on with Guillermo Martinez, which is intent and which is approach. And which is how to like get through this. It's so remarkable how thorough the scouting is these days, that as soon as Davis Schneider got to the big leagues, that's where everyone was attacking him. Like, they, like, teams knew that just based off what he's done in the minors. Like, that's how thorough the detail of scouting is. This guy who was a non-prospect, who's completely off the radar, teams knew right away.
Yeah. And this is, you know, we have the Statcast and more importantly video for everything. I mean, we don't publicly necessarily for everything in the minors, but they do.
Yep.
And the Cleveland Guardians could go to their AAA team and be like, give us everything you got. And what, you know, let us talk to some of your pitchers and things like that. The other thing about the high heat, particularly for a shorter guy like Davis Schneider, and I asked him about this a little bit, and the conversation ended up being more about the ABS and challenge system generally. Yeah. But a suspicion I've heard a number of people say is that, and I wonder if MLB gives us data on this at some point and just like, hey, here are the results from AAA with the ABS and challenge system and stuff. High strikes to shorter players tend to be, people seem to think that's the area that human umpires struggle with the most, because they don't adjust the height of the strike zone to the letter of the law. And so when you look at AAA, Davis Schneider is getting more of those shadow balls, whereas in the majors, that is more frequently a strike, even if that's not the correct call.
Not only Davis Schneider, like Spencer Horowitz, another guy who figured that out.
8 hits this weekend.
And has gamified that. Like, that when you look at some of the walk rates, like the International League, league-wide walk rate is 12%.
360 OBP league-wide.
It's crazy. And Schneider and Horowitz and other guys with like really, you know, good pitch recognition skills have figured that out. You use that to their advantage in AAA, but then you get to the majors and all of a sudden those pitches are strikes again.
Yeah.
But for Davis Schneider, like if he's 0-0 and he gets a high ball strike, that's okay, right? Mm-hmm. Like if he's 1-1 even and he goes to 1-2, that's okay. Anything before two strikes, like if it's not in a damage zone up, take it. If you get striked, that's fine. Go into battle mode with two strikes, like you can still do that. But give the pitcher an opportunity to throw you something in a better spot. Like the double yesterday was a mistake pitch, mm-hmm. and Davis Schneider got to that because of his plate approach, right? And because of pitches that he was taking. It's similar to what Dalton Varsho is doing right now. He's just improved his swing decisions. He's narrowed his swing zone. So he's getting to better pitches to hit, and he can do damage against mistakes. So that's part of the intent for Davis Schneider is like, if it's that shadow zone up, you got to take that pitch
until there's two strikes and then you fend it off.
Exactly.
And I think that's, you know, that's an important consideration. Whenever we talk about swing decisions or chase rate and things like that, it's not just about not swinging at bad pitches. It is about making sure the swings you're taking are on good pitches you can do damage with, because yeah, it doesn't hurt your chase rate to swing at a high fastball that is technically a strike. But if you can't do damage with it, you would much rather continue to work that plate appearance until you get something you can do more damage with. And I think this is, you know, kind of what Bo Bichette has been getting at a couple times when he talks about going up with a plan of attack. Bo is very, very aggressive, but he's very good at being aggressive. Hey, this chunk of the plate or this pitch that I'm looking for. And then, hey, with two strikes, I'm maybe the best defensive two-strike hitter in baseball, so I can wait it out.
That's why it's funny when Bo says stuff like that. Yeah. He's like, why don't you guys just do what I do?
It's like when
you're a freak of nature and you can get your barrel to anything.
It's like, I remember in interleague play when Zach Greinke was on his first tour with the Royals and he would like do BP and hitting games and then like openly talk about his teammate and not understand, like, why don't you just go up and hit a home run? Like, yeah, this is what the pitcher is obviously going to do in this situation, and I can hit a home run, so why don't you?
Yeah, Bo's like, it's a preternatural ability to just get his barrel to pitches, like his bat to ball, his hand eye is just elite, elite, elite. So he can do things at the plate. He can have an approach at the plate that other players simply cannot, because Bo's got a different swing for every pitch, for every quadrant of the zone. A lot of players, some of them on this team, who have one swing for one quadrant, and that's what they're trying to get to.
Yeah, and hey, it can work if you're very, very good in it, but it makes you a little slump prone and a little game plan prone, and some of these sharper teams with pitchers who can, you know, this is maybe why the guys who execute 5-6 pitches to a couple different zones have had more luck against the Blue Jays than the pure stuff guys.
I do think so.
The pure stuff guys, it's harder to hit, but if that match, you know, if a Hunter Green high inside fastball to a lefty is something that that lefty deals well with, poor example in that case with who the Jays have, but yeah, you know, that's if that line, if your stuff lines up with something a Blue Jay can do versus Kyle Gibson, who can throw 6 pitches in 4 zones and yeah, kind of work around your strengths, there's maybe something to that.
That's one of the reasons why the Dean Kramers, the Kyle Gibsons have success against the Blue Jays. Like, I've heard that from people around the team. It's just like, yeah, we don't really adjust our swings all that much in games. Like, and that part of that comes down to your personnel, right? And what kind of players you have and what kind of swings they have. Like I said, not everybody's Bo Bichette. Mm-hmm. Some guys have like one area of the zone that they like where they do damage and where their swing is good at it. And they're trying to get to that pitch. And if you're Dean Kramer, you can, the first time up, like, throw fastballs away, and the second time up, throw cutters in and show different looks, and hitters are going to have a hard time adjusting to that.
Well, if you make the playoffs and you end up in the third wildcard spot, you draw a Twins team that has a bunch of pitchers who are good at that kind of stuff. Pablo Lopez, who has both, he's like, here's the stuff, and also I'm going to junk and change pitches on the fly and ditch the league's best changeup for a sweeper at times. And
Sonny Gray.
Yeah, Joe Ryan, a lot of guys who can, I mean, Bailey Ober, who gave the Jays a lot of trouble with the high spin, high extension down the mound, fastballs and stuff. But you got to get there first. We're going to take a break. We're going to check your confidence level in that even happening as the Jays sit 2.5 out here. Start a 3-game set with the Nats tonight. Arden Zwelling staying with us as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Smart takes on the biggest stories in sports. The Fan Drive Time with Ben Ennis. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays will start a 3-game set against the Nationals and a 12-game stretch. It was a 15-game stretch on Friday against bad teams, and the Nationals maybe don't qualify anymore. They've won 11 of 15 and are no longer in last place in the NL East, so we can't even do the thing of, hey, they're going to play 4 last place teams in a row. Regardless of who the competition is, though, the Blue Jays need to get going, and we've heard some quotes from managers that aren't radio-friendly. We've heard quotes from players that show there's an urgency here and a frustration level. Blue Jays are 2.5 games out, 30 games to go. Mathematically, practically, this is very, very possible still, even if it doesn't feel that way. Arden Zwelling, who is still with us here, how do you feel about where the Jays sit in this playoff race right now? 2.5 games out, a bit of lighter competition here, and then a chance to do some damage against the Texas Rangers after this 12-game stretch. But they're running out of time a little bit here.
So they got 31 games left,
mm-hmm.
and they're sitting on 71 wins. Those mm-hmm. are the facts. I think you want 90 to feel reasonably confident about reaching the postseason.
19 and 12.
So you got to go 19 and 12, right? And that's, you know, that sounds daunting. It's not unheard of. Last season, the Blue Jays won 20 times over their final 31 games. The season before that, they won 22. So we've seen them do this. Each of the last two seasons, they waited until September to make their run. For one reason or another, I don't know why. So when you consider the fact that they literally just did better than that each of the last two seasons, you can foresee them going 19 and 12 the rest of the way, particularly considering the fact they have like the softest strength of schedule, objectively, via Fangraphs, not just saying this, objectively, yep. of any of the teams in this race.
And but those six games against the Yankees look a lot different now than they did a couple weeks back, too.
But they still have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, during that time, all those AL West teams will start beating up on each other because like Texas is going to play Seattle and like they're all going to play each other. So someone has to lose those games.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, you know, you're not today. I would put them like 50-50 to make the playoffs.
It's almost exactly where Fangraphs has them.
Or this Fangraphs maybe a little
48.
Bit below?
48.5.
Yeah. So around, I'd say it's 50-50, essentially, which is not where you want to be.
Nope.
Those were the expectations entering the season, externally or internally, for this team. The divisions are right off. You're not getting there.
10.5, yeah.
You got 31 games to play. Don't lose more than 12 times the rest of the way. That's
and
the way to look at it.
If you start losing two to the Guardians, obviously that they're not in the sample you're talking about, but we would have sat here on the weekend and said, yeah, you got to win. You got to go 20-14, and they've already burned two of those losses now against the Guardians, and if you burn them against Washington and then the three last place teams you're playing, it's going to be pretty frustrating. So
you're going to want to get a sweep in there. You're going to want to sweep Oakland or sweep Kansas City. Like you're going
Colorado is, I mean, the park's weird, but they're just like irredeemably bad right now.
Sweep Colorado. The thing is, Washington's like one of the better teams in baseball
they're
since
good
the All-Star
yeah.
break. They're another weird team too that kind of gives Toronto trouble where they don't strike out a lot, they don't walk a lot, and they just put the ball in play.
Yeah.
And they make a ton
Twins-ish.
Of contact. Yeah, right? So, sort of Cleveland-ish,
yeah.
honestly, and Cleveland gives them trouble. So you want to try to beat up on some Washington pitching, but I don't know, you kind of beat up on Cleveland pitching,
yeah.
too, and it didn't go so well.
It didn't, I guess, with the exception of Tanner Bibee, who still has your number for whatever reason. Okay, so part of why the Jays are left here to need to go on a run in September is that they haven't gone on a run yet. They have had one win streak of five games or longer this year. They had a six game streak earlier in the year. That is the only time they've railed off five or more in a row. Excuse me. You don't have to win 10, 12, 15 games in a row to be a good baseball team. We did the math earlier. If you went 4-3 every week, you'd let, what was it? 90 or 91.
You're doing 91 games.
So almost exactly where the Jays would land if they won 19 of their last 31 here. They would,
and then you would win the World Series
because
you would win four out of every seven.
Yes.
right? You would win 91 and the World Series if you go 4-3 every week throughout the season.
Yes. That's probably not going to play out that way. It probably doesn't make anyone feel better.
Would you sign up for that if you could? Because you're signing up for a World Series, right? That's what you're getting.
You are. You're also signing up for a very frustrating regular season, but hey, here we are. Most good teams, most even mediocre teams, will go on a run longer than six games at some point. Last year, the Blue Jays had three win streaks of five or more. The year before that in 2021, which included a very hot September, they had four such win streaks. You go back to 2015, obviously they were just like five-game win streak after five-game win streak in the second half. Even those 2017 to 2020 lean years, they were able to rail off one or two, five, six, seven-game win streaks. That the Blue Jays haven't done that this year. Again, the 1 6-game win streak. Jokes aside about 4-3 would win you the World Series. What do you attribute that to? The fact that this team has not, like, it's not completely true that every World Series champion will have at some point during that season felt like the best team in baseball for a week or two. But most of the best teams will do that at some point. There will be a stretch where you look unbeatable and you look like things are clicking. And that just hasn't happened for the Blue Jays yet.
It's the answer to every question in baseball. When you take anything in baseball and you say, what do you attribute that to? And the honest answer for every single question is random variance. That's the answer. And that's the answer for that. And that's the answer for everything. And it's so unsatisfying, right? And you tell people that, like, no, I want a nice, tidy, clean narrative. I want a silver bullet. I want there to be one thing. I want there to be one person we can fire, or one guy we can trade, or one person who we blame, one play that wasn't made, one swing. Like, we talked about yesterday's game and all the moments and all the different decisions could have been made.
The Biggio bunt decision, the Schneider pinch run for Kiermaier, the Jay Jackson over Bowden Francis, etc.
We don't mention that George Springer hit a ball 405 feet to dead center that Miles Straw caught at the height of the wall. And maybe if there's rain in the forecast and the roof is closed, that ball's out.
I thought Springer was going to destroy something in the dugout.
I may be able to confirm that he did.
Oh, okay.
Without going any further. Yeah. Yes, I have a good seat for that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. That's like yet another thing, right, in mm-hmm. that game that could have gone the other way. It's just, it's a crazy, fluky sport. And if you watch 9 innings every day, I mean, it's random variance. Like, a lot of things are going to happen that are all going to work in concert with one another to create these outcomes. I think that's why, like, so many front office types, when they speak publicly to people like me in scrums, like, sound so detached and sounds so aloof.
Especially here.
But it's every market, Blake.
Yeah, like I know.
It's every guy and it's every GM, it's every club president now, right? Yeah. Like, it's Derek Falvey, it's Chris Antonetti, it's Heim Bloom, it's
Cashman.
Like, they all sound so detached and aloof because they kind of have to be, because they understand how much randomness they're up against and how chaotic these outcomes can be. And that the best they can do is try to put the percentages in their favor and put the odds in their favor.
So I can understand that from a front office perspective. I can, you know, disagree with it being your core PR strategy down the stretch when the fan base is a little frustrated, but I can understand it. Obviously, this is a little, those bursts of randomness, the waves of variance, the Drunkard's Walk is the book, right, on how to understand randomness in real life. That is probably a lot more frustrating to live through day to day and inning to inning if you are a part of that coaching staff, and certainly if you're a part of the lineup. What is your read on, you know, we've heard comments from Gausman, from Bassett, from John Schneider on this team's inability, focus more on the urgency to get this run, but a little bit reflecting on the inability to put, you know, things together. I don't think you can go to those guys and be like, hey, George Springer, like, that ball got caught. Randomness, that sucks, right? What else
do you blame, right? Like, what else can you say when you hit a ball 405 feet?
I know.
Go out?
It's, but like, those things happen. And it's, I don't think, I have not hit a ball like that got robbed, but I'd imagine it's really annoying to hear it.
Yeah.
And to try to like compartmentalize that's a part of it and process over results when you're 2.5 games out with 31 to go here.
And you're 600 plate appearances into a grind of a season, and you've been playing every day, and you're mentally worn out and fatigued physically and just completely like beaten down by the relentless failure that you have been dealing with for the prior 5 months. In that moment, the last thing you want to hear is random variance, particularly when all year we've been talking about how George Springer has the amazing expected stats because of his contact quality. And then you hear the GM come out the other day and say, hey, we make great contact. Like, we love our contact quality. Our underlying metrics suggest that, like, we should go on a run and that we should start performing better offensively. I don't know what else you can do other than just like yell at the sky.
I think it's yell at the sky time. We're starting to see it, right? Though, right? And like, I joked about, you know, John Schneider swearing in a lot of quotes lately, but I do think like that's our best proxy for urgency is like, hey, the quotes are getting more extreme and guys are showing the frustration more. If you are in that room though, how are you managing that this last little bit? Because if that's not a message that guys can hear, you obviously have to stay them on focus. And there are some veterans on this team, but like, I'd imagine they are ascribing a lot more of what's happening to things they can control than things they can't control right now.
Chris Bassett said the other day, because I asked him a question similar to this of like, how do you deal essentially? And he said, you just focus on tomorrow and you just think about tomorrow. And it's like one of the rare instances in life where actually it makes sense to just focus on the next tree rather than the forest.
Mm-hmm.
You only win one game every day. So what can you do to win that game, to be a little bit better, to find a better outcome? It's not the kind of sport where like trying harder is a thing. Or
right, that's how you end up as Danny Jansen, you know, trying to turn a double into a triple and your heart's in the right place, but you don't get there and it's the wrong read.
Right. But like part of what made Danny Jansen a better hitter over the last several years was not trying harder and just buying into his approach and what works for him and saying like, yeah, I'm not going to try to be this all fields guy. I'm going to just be a pull hitter and I'm just going to simplify this. So I think that as a player, you really do just simplify it to like, what's the game tomorrow? What's Josiah Gray throw? What's my approach against him? How are we going to win this game? Like, I wish there was like one like fell swoop. I wish there was a magic bullet. Like, I wish there was like one chord, one string you can pull. Surely John Schneider would have pulled it by now if it existed.
And here's where I get into, if things were perfect and we knew by the end of 162, everything would tidally, like if 162 was the perfect sample size and everything would land in the right place, yeah. I'd look at someone like a team like the Washington Nationals that has been hot lately, but overperformed. I'd look at a guy like Josiah Gray, whose expected stats are all like a run worse than his actual ERA. He has a whip of almost 1.5, but a sub 4 ERA. Bad hard hit data, doesn't strike a lot of guys out, not a huge whiff rate, all of these things, and yet he's still... And I'd be like, okay, that's the guy. The positive regression here, negative regression here, let's go. This would be one of those instances. Obviously, it doesn't work that way. Another guy tonight, another righty that throws 7 different pitches, could be more of a mess. What are you looking for from... we got 3 minutes left here.
You got to force guys like that to execute. That's what Dean Kramer did really well. He executed his cutter really well. Kyle Gibson talked to some people with the Blue Jays after like that start. Like, just he executed really well.
Sinker, yeah.
To the edges, right? Like, kind of went left when hitters thought he was going right. Kind of stayed ahead of it. You see it the other way with Noah Syndergaard. Didn't execute some pitches very well yesterday, and the Blue Jays did some damage against them, right? So you got to try to force those guys to make mistakes over the heart of the plate.
Syndergaard, a little salt in the wound, him getting DFA'd after the game.
After a win, like, everybody's celebrating and having a good time. Yeah. And you know they had to do it quick because it's a getaway day, right? Yeah. So they straight into Tito's office. Hey, man.
And like, you didn't pitch well, but you gave them length. You gave them 6 innings. He's probably looking at like, what more do you, you're out of the playoff race. The only thing you are asking for right now is eat some innings so we don't have to burn service time on the next guy.
Yeah, that would have been a tough pill. So you can see some of that like regression happen quickly with like, just back to your earlier point with relievers. You look at Jimmy Garcia right now, like you look at his regression back to the guy who he's been. You look yesterday of Jay Jackson, who threw a really bad pitch, right? And who had been playing much better than you would have projected him to for a long time. You should expect some regression for Garcia and for Jackson in different directions. That can happen a lot quicker with the short samples of relievers, with hitters. It's not always so perfect, but didn't you know right recently that a hitter can turn the season around in 1 month?
Yes. It was a good piece. And if Eno weren't on the West Coast, I would have asked him to come on and talk about this morning, but, coming off the weekend, I don't want to ask him that. So the Jays will get in action tonight, 7:00, Kevin Gausman against Josiah Gray, Jose Berríos against Mackenzie Gore tomorrow, Chris Bassett against Patrick Corbin in the 3 PM start on Wednesday. As we discussed earlier, with righty, lefty, lefty coming up, maybe it's a Davis Schneider off night tonight, even though he's been, you could also keep his bat in, but he's definitely starting the next 2 days. We'll hear more on Matt Chapman a little bit later, hear more on Bo Bichette a little bit later, see if those guys are in the lineup. As an update, if you missed it earlier, Chad Green pitched Saturday and Sunday. He is as close can be, but rosters expand Friday, so maybe we'll just wait that one out. Spencer Horwitz, 8-hit weekend. Arden says not on the radar to come up and
where's
hit
he gonna play?
One plate appearance a week.
Whose playing time is he taking?
Nobody's.
Brandon Belt's
and David Schneider already can't get in. So right?
Yeah, it's Belt or Vlad's got to sit if you want to play Horwitz.
Yep, which is tough. And they've tried every single player at AAA at second base so far this year. From what I heard, his stint there, his 2 games there, did not go the greatest. Jays with a 48.5% chance of making the playoffs as of this morning. They'll try to tilt that in the right direction tonight. Gausman against Josiah Gray. Jesse Rubinoff and Brent Gunning coming up next. Blair and Barker have you 5-7 to tee that game up proper. They'll also have post game for you. Of course, we'll have it on TV. Dan Shulman continues to pull double duty with Canada Basketball, who play at 9:30 a.m. tomorrow. So send your energy and coffees to Dan Shulman this next little bit. Ben Wagner And I think Madison Shipman on the call. I should double check that. But we'll have it for you on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Arden Zwelling, thanks for taking the hour out, man. I appreciate it.
Anytime you want to talk deadlifts, I'm here.
Yeah, we'll do it. We'll try to get him on the show and bring you back on. Thanks to David Schoenfield as well. Thanks to Jeff, Lance, and Jennifer behind the glass. We'll talk to you at 10 a.m. tomorrow.